What else could go wrong with my day? Who's there? Oh no, here comes the colonel.
Ah, yes, once again, the comedian's down the hall auditioning for Comedy Central, sneaking in here to disrupt a serious science program. Well, welcome back to the second half hour of The Promise of Tomorrow here on the Science News Radio Network. I'm your host, I'm Colonel Mason. We've got an exciting second half for you today. Jack Bishop's going to tell us about it in just a minute. And of course, at the end of the program, listener comments and the voice of reason. But right now, let's step over to our fountain of useless information we keep here on the set. Rummage around the coin jar a little bit here for today's mystery question. What do you say?
Welcome to the fountain of useless information. How can I help?
Yes, yes, yes. We see once again that we have summoned the spirit of the fountain, who knows all, hears all, sees all, and tells all for a price. That's the reason we do the coins in the fountain. All right, oh spirit of the fountain, here is one for you. Put on your thinking cap or your shower cap or whatever kind of cap. What British princess died in February 2002, 1 month before the book 69 Things to Do with a Dead Princess hit the shelves in Britain? What British princess died in 2002 before a book titled 69 Things to Do with a Dead Princess was scheduled to be released in the bookstores in Britain?
I have given you my answer. And now you may tell
the old spirit of the fountain knows, but I'm not sure the rest of us do, because I had guessed wrong. The British princess died in February 2002, a month before the book 69 Things to Do with a Dead Princess hit the bookstores in Britain. If you said, sadly, Princess Diana, you are wrong. It was Princess Margaret. Yes, it was. Yeah, I said Diana, too. Okay, well, back with our program. Jack Bishop, what's our lineup?
Promise of Tomorrow radio program, Jack Bishop here. Let's talk about energy. Seems like we spend a lot of time doing that on this program, so let's talk about it from an area that fascinates me. Maria Richards is at SMU. She is the Geothermal Laboratories Coordinator in the Huffington Department of Earth Sciences. Her research is on geothermal resources and energy development. Projects that she's involved in vary from computer-generated temperature depth maps for Google all the way to geothermal exploration of the volcanic islands in the Northern Mariana Islands. She has a master's degree in science and physical geography from the University of Tennessee in Knoxville. Can I say it, Maria? Go Vols?
Oh, totally. Go Vols. Yeah.
and a BS in environmental geography from Michigan State University. And you're involved currently in a thing that I had never heard of until just a few moments ago when you and I were talking off mic. You're involved in what is called geoconversion of oil and gas wells into geothermal energy producers. And I must say, this fascinates me, if for no other reason than the fact that it never occurred to me that this could be done. How do you know, for those of us who haven't got who slept through science classes, how do you do this?
So the concept is somewhat simple sounding, but there's a lot that goes into it in converting a well. But first of all, I want to say thank you, Jack, for inviting me to be on the show.
Oh, my pleasure.
A real pleasure for me as well. So thank you for this. And I find that in going out and giving presentations that you can start with some basic concepts about the fact that oil and gas and water are all separate inside the earth, just like if you take your salad dressing and you have to shake it at night before you put it on that salad, because of the fact that the oil will separate from the water, and that the water is at the bottom and the oil floats to the top. Gas floats to the top of the oil usually. And so when you drill a well, that these oil and gas companies of ours are very, you know, talented. They're experts in the field at knowing where the gas lines are, where the oil lines are, and where the water lines are within the earth below our feet. And so they keep the perforations above those water lines as much as possible, because as everybody knows, we don't want water in our oil and gas lines. So we got to separate that out.
Now, when I hear the term geothermal, I think of Old Faithful, or I think of somewhere in Scandinavia where steam is bubbling out of the ground. And how,
that place is like Iceland.
Yeah. You know, we have these pictures in our mind, and now you come along and say, well, where there's oil and gas, there may very well be geothermal. How do you discover? You said it's, you know, the people drilling know it, but how do you discover the good wells from the ones that are not going to be as productive?
So the oil and gas industry is doing a really good job of helping us find the sites that we are most interested in. That what you're talking about in terms of geothermal are all what we would consider more near surface manifestations. So,
all right.
You know, a hot spring.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, so, you know, like Arkansas has hot springs, you know, National Park. So that's a case where the water is coming out of the, you know, out from a spring from the ground that's hotter than expected. And then in western United States, in Northern California, there's a place called the Geysers. And that's one of the largest geothermal reservoirs in the world, right here in the United States. And it's one of the biggest geothermal power plant producers in the world because of that. And so that's like a deep, hot reservoir that's under steam pressure. And so that's a very unusual feature. But, and then you have places like Yellowstone, where you have the heat because of it being a hot spot below it, heating up the ground at a level that the heat is being transferred to the surface fast enough that you can then, you know, it's putting water under pressure. So the geysers, like Old Faithful, you know, shoots out, you know, every so many minutes to hours. And what we're looking at in terms of geothermal is the idea that, you know, geothermal is the heat, or like the heat from the earth. And what, with technology, what we would like to be able to do is take that heat and generate electricity from it. So that's the big concept of what our research is here at SMU, is on the high resource temperatures that are capable of producing electricity. But we're also aware that any place where you are able just to tap into the Earth's heat itself. So, for instance, some people have geothermal heat pumps related to their house. That would be an example where, even on a home level, they are using the heat to offset the need for heating or cooling. So, in the summer, the Earth is actually cooler than the surface, and so then they use that for cooling their house. So, it's the idea of offsetting the need for electricity in those cases by using the Earth.
So it's a pretty wide range of possibilities there.
Yes. That's right. So that's where it gets confusing, because of the fact that when you say geothermal to somebody who's in contracting of, you know, buildings, and like the Green Building Association, they think, oh, it's, you know, that heat pump that we can, you know, put on our homes, or, you know, to, you know, there's a building up in Plano that's 100% geothermal cooled, for instance. Whereas when I say geothermal, I think electricity. Let's generate electricity from it. So those, the electricity side tends to be hotter because you get the energy efficiency that you need. And from that, we're talking about temperatures that are typically at least in Texas at like 200 degrees Fahrenheit, mm-hmm. or hotter is what we're looking for. And what we consider high temperature geothermal is really 300 degrees or higher.
And those temperatures are found farther down.
Correct.
Now, how do you convert all of these wells into producing geothermal wells? What is the technology there?
Yes. So, as I was saying, that the oil and gas is doing a great job of helping us better understand, you know, the where the Earth's temperature is, you know, varies, and in places like South Texas, they're drilling wells even at 10,000 feet that are over 250, some close to 300 degrees Fahrenheit. And so they are drilling into temperatures that are hot enough to generate electricity.
So the steam coming up from those wells, power turbines?
Yes. And so in reality, it's more fluid because it's under pressure that comes to the surface. And then when it gets to the surface, it will either flash to a steam itself if it's hot enough. And that's where like the 300 degree Fahrenheit wells would be more likely to do that. Whereas if you're in the 250 or even you can get as low as 200, which is less than boiling. Boiling is 212 degrees Fahrenheit. You're able to use a secondary fluid. It's called a working fluid.
And a working fluid would be what?
And that working fluid is like an isopentane.
Now, you just talked way over my pay grade.
Okay.
Isopentane? Yeah.
Pentane, right. So it's things like antifreeze.
Oh, okay.
So it's a lot, there's a lot of commonalities to your air conditioner, and that your air conditioner uses the, you know, you pull outside air in, through the fans, which then there's a condenser that is using the fluid in your air conditioner to take that and extract the heat out of it to cool the air, and that is your working fluid. And so, and as you know, like, you don't typically leak your fluid out with your air conditioner, and these geothermal power plants are designed in the same way, where they have a side where they, so rather than air being pulled through, we have water being pulled through from the ground. So you have hot water being pulled through as your initial fluid, and then you have the working fluid that is in a secondary loop that starts out as a, you know, there's a known amount, so like a container of fluid that is run through a cycle that is able to flash to a steam at a lower temperature, depending on which fluid it is. So less than, so let's say somewhere in like the 150 to 180 range, depending on the different fluids, and some are higher than that. But then the goal is that fluid then will be recondensed back to a liquid so it can work some more. So it's in a closed loop.
Now, geothermal as a way to produce electricity is really not a new concept, but it's just finally getting to the point of economic practicality, right?
There's a couple of, right, I'll say yes to that. It's not new because in the United States, we've had geothermal power plants since the 1960s. So it's been going on for a long time. What has happened is that we have new technology that is able to use these lower temperatures. And, you know, previously, the focus of the geothermal community was really on temperatures at least 300 degrees Fahrenheit or higher. And now we're talking about temperatures that are 200 degrees in Texas. And, you know, I'm working with a group that's looking at even a brand new technology that might be able to drop that to 170 degrees Fahrenheit. And so, you know, every time you drop it even a few degrees, it's significant in terms of being able to tap into more and more of these wells that the oil and gas company are drilling.
Now, we're seeing all kinds of discussions about alternative energy sources and delivery and generation. And what I guess I want to ask is, in the pie chart of energy making, what should we expect? What part of that pie chart should we expect to be geothermal in the coming years?
You know, that's a great question, because what's intriguing to me, having now worked at SMU for almost 20 years, is that when I got into the industry, the geothermal community was really dominant for renewables because it had been existing since the 1960s, and the capability of it being base load power made it look like it was going to be, you know, the number one renewable energy. But what we've seen in the last 10 years is where the wind industry has done a really good job of both marketing and leasing and getting the product out into the field. And solar has reduced its pricing and its size and its capabilities as well. So those two industries are doing really well. What we are finding is that within geothermal, it's a lot harder for the average person to grasp what's happening. You know, we talk about it being below our feet. People don't understand that there's heat literally being released from the earth all the time.
So when you say below our feet, you mean literally below our feet.
Exactly. Yep. Everywhere on this earth, there's heat below our feet. And so that's something that, you know, it, you really need to be in more the geology type professions to be able to start working with that concept and working on these fields, whereas it's more the sales and the technologies of wind and solar. Like, people can feel the wind, you know, and solar on their faces, and I think it's easier for the, you know, for that product to get out. And it's also easier to measure. Like, you can stick a parameter, you know, like a measuring device, and say, this is how much wind is here. Where we're now coming into using the oil and gas information as our parameter to say how much heat is below the ground. And we are also now working together with the oil and gas industry to better understand the fluid flow below the earth. Because in geothermal, we're going to be pulling out and re-injecting fluid into the earth, and that fluid turns into a giant cycle where you pull it out from one place and then re-inject it in another, and it will slowly work its way back to where you will produce it again.
Also, so, isn't part of the equation the fact that solar, in particular, wind, to some degree, are sexy developmental ideas. You know, they've got a certain emotional appeal that maybe geothermal doesn't have. We're talking about stuff that with solar and to some extent even with wind power is kind of Star Trek-y in a way.
So I've never thought about Star Trek-y, but we do agree that it's marketing in some respects, and it is a fact that the concept is easy to grasp onto. So at one point we were trying to come up with a sexy appeal for geothermal, and we were thinking, well, maybe we should become the brawny guys. You know, there's the one paper towels, and they came up with the brawny ads. You know, something more along those lines, because it tends to be a lot of geologists out in the field or working around computers with high technology. And we tend to be more laid-back personalities. Mm-hmm. And so, we're, you know, we laugh. We're down to earth, you know. And so, yes, but there's no doubt that that is part of the equation. So, but we also realize that we are a baseload technology, and so it's very difficult to get the wind or solar to blow constantly or to be out constantly with solar. Whereas with geothermal, if you want to try to replace a coal plant, geothermal can compete with that because coal plants never shut down, and geothermal energy plants never shut down.
Always there, always the
right.
Always that heat below our feet.
Yeah.
Now, this leads me to the next question. As I understand it, and you correct me if I'm wrong, geothermal is doable right now, doable today, and doable pretty quick and inexpensively.
Yes, 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 and more yes.
So why is it I'm not hearing more about it? Other than the fact it's marketing, but why is it we aren't on a national level excited about doing something that we can do today and do at a reasonable cost?
So I guess I'm going to back out the reasonable cost for you.
All right.
And that we are working with the oil and gas industry is at least the focus here at SMU and our research, and we're working more on trying to get this into the oil and gas segment, so that's where we're focusing on. And the oil and gas industry pretty much has a success rate, they say, for a turnaround time of 2 years or less. So when they're looking to say, where's the next well we're going to drill, they're expecting that next well will pay it back in about 2 years. And with geothermal and these binary technologies that are ready to go, the payback is not that fast. So depending on the energy efficiency, so if something is coming at 200 degrees Fahrenheit or something that's 300 degrees Fahrenheit, you're going to have a different payback schedule for those two examples. But so you're looking at something that's probably closer to, you know, 3 to 7 years even.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the oil and gas industry isn't necessarily
looking at the payback.
Interest.
Looking at the payback ratio, I can understand that. Now, I always like to ask people who do the things that you do this question: any countries doing a better job at getting this online for their citizens?
China is one of the countries that we were really surprised to see them starting to show up at meetings and report in what they're doing, and that in central China they have an oil field that they are now converting, and they've started the process, and they're going to be converting it over to 100% geothermal over the next 4 to 6 years. And so that's the first field that will be in the world that will have converted from oil to geothermal.
Totally converted.
Yes.
Wow. Something to certainly keep our eyes on. And what do you see as the next thing on the horizon for geothermal?
Well, I'm excited about this new technology that I mentioned that can drop the temperatures down to like 170. So if you're up in Alaska, where the air temperature is so much colder, they already can produce at 165. So that's but that's a different scenario. And we got to talk about Texas. We're in Dallas. So having a new technology that's coming from a very, they're actually coming from the more like the waste heat and computer industry. And so it's a technology that wasn't designed for geothermal at all. So that's kind of crossing borders. I'm aware that, well, right now, before you called, I was working on a request for proposals from the Department of Energy related to looking at new innovative methods and technology to better understand them at a pore space level. So really small spacing, how fluid flow is happening in the reservoirs. And so I think we're going to be moving towards something called EGS, for Enhanced Geothermal Systems, which is big power plants. So these will be like 100 to 500 megawatt power plants, where a typical geothermal power plant today is more in the 15 to 25 megawatt power plant.
Big step up there.
Yeah, so a big step up. And these plants are going to be designed for, you know, at a 100-year, you know, starting life cycle. But they're, it's a nice mix by overlapping with the oil and gas knowledge that's really taking the knowledge of the horizontal drilling and the fracking and understanding how do we pull gas out of these shale plays, and for us to be working with them and overlapping and both of us improving now on our ability to look at the earth below our feet and the resources that are there waiting to be tapped into.
Like you said, it's right there below our feet. Our guest today has been Maria Richards from SMU's Geothermal Laboratory. She's the coordinator of that in the Huffington Department of Earth Sciences. And we've been talking about geothermal energy production from oil wells. Maria, thank you for being with us here on The Promise of Tomorrow.
Jack, you are so welcome. You've done a wonderful job with this interview.
And at this time, I want to thank you very much for those of you who have contributed to the this program. We depend on contributions from listeners like you for the existence of this show. We're totally science community supported. So those of you who have contributed, thank you very much. Those of you who wish to can do so at our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz. On the right-hand side of your screen, you'll see a little tab there for donations. Just click the donations, and we appreciate all your help.
And now, we make time for the voice of reason. Listener comments, ideas, and suggestions.
Don't try to pick a project because it looks easy, because they all turn out to be hard anyway. So you might as well work on something important because it won't be any harder. It's Alan Marshall. I'm a professor of chemistry and biochemistry at Florida State University, and I also direct the ion cyclotron resonance program, which is a kind of mass spectrometry at the National High Magnetic Field Lab in Tallahassee, Florida.
So you decide, has this really been the voice of reason? Listener comments are welcome at 214-329-4949. And please tell us your name and where you're from.
You've been listening to The Promise of Tomorrow with Colonel Mason, the definitive program on emerging and nanotechnologies, now archived and streamed on the web at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Join us next week at the same time as we learn more about the promise of tomorrow.
We live tomorrow, 'cause you know what will be there. I am waiting for you. I am waiting for you.